Okay, so we're going to continue our discussion regarding orbits on the Kars spacetime. So remember, we're restricting to equatorial orbits on our Kars spacetime. And so we worked out this the geodesic equation in terms of the conserved quantities, energy, and angular momentum gives you this. We define this right hand quantity to be this quote unquote effective potential. And then we argued that if we, so we can factor out an R from this quantity here, that these terms all are linear or higher order in R. And so we argued that since this for our bound orbits, which our energy is, or E tilde is less than one, we know that it's V is positive here, we're not allowed to go out to infinity. And then we can have two situations where we can sort of have, you know, we also argued that this quantity goes negative by the time we reach the horizon at R plus. And so since this view of R is a cubic, we can have this situation here, or we can have a situation like this. And so the allowed orbits are where V is less than or equal to zero. So for example, you have an orbit here where the turning points would be these two radii, go back and forth between there. We have another orbit that would just fall into the black hole here. And for this case, you'd only be able to fall back into a black hole. But there's a marginal case in between these two, and that's where both V and its derivative would be equal to zero. So that would look something like, well, it could either look like this, or we could look like that. But these would correspond to the circular orbits, where you would just sit at one particular radius. So that would correspond to a circular orbit. So we're interested in solving for those. So those correspond to V and its derivative are equal to zero. So we'd be interested in finding the values where this happens, and we'll call that the circular radius. Basically, if we have two conditions here that we can solve and set to zero, and that would allow us to solve for our two variables, the energy and the angular momentum. So I'm not going to go through the math, it gets a little messy, but basically two equations, two unknowns, you solve for them and you get the following. Energy of a circular orbit, and for the angular momentum, like this, and then the denominator is the same as here. a couple of remarks here. So here I've restricted to the convention that the angular momentum is positive. Because these are particles that have positive angular momentum. But then I'm allowing a black hole spin to be positive or negative. And of course, there's this transformation where you could basically flip your orientation and let the angular momentum of your geodesic, your test particle, have go to the opposite sign, and then switch the black hole to have the opposite sign as well. Basically, what matters is whether you're prograde or retrograde with the black, with respect to the black hole spin. So here I'm choosing the particle as positive angular momentum, but A can be positive or negative. So let's examine these expressions in a couple different limits. So first, let's just take the...
What do you know about RC? And do you know RC? Because why are you solving E tail C and J tail C with this RC? Don't people usually find the circular orbit by solving those two equations?
Yeah, so exactly. So...
So now you wrote everything in terms of the radius, but how do you know RC?
I'm defining RC as the place where these are equal to zero. So you'll get more than one solution, right? So there'll be a range of values basically that you're allowed to have, and for each of those values, you'll have a value of energy and a value of angular momentum. And right now we're going to discuss basically what the allowed values are, but there are a whole range of them. Yeah, so first let's consider the Newtonian case where we're far away from our black hole. So radius much larger than M. So in that case, we can take a look at this and the sort of leading contribution is just going to be the following, for the energy. So this is just the rest mass of the particle one, and this is the Newtonian expression you expect for the sort of the binding energy of a circular orbit. So that makes sense. And then same thing for the angular momentum. Just get the expression you get for a circular orbit in Newtonian gravity. So that all makes sense. Now let's consider sort of the more extreme case. So we notice that both these quantities have a denominator here. So we can consider what values these denominators will actually blow up. The denominators will go to zero, so that G will, and angular momentum will blow up. Say that denominator is equal to zero, make an expression like this. So basically, this tells you there's actually a lower bound on the radius, and we expect, like, for example, the energy to look something like this, and there should be this minimum value that's given by solving this equation here. So I could write down the general solution here, but then it would be more illustrative to consider several different limits of this. So So one case is just where we consider non-spinning. So that's A bar equals to zero. So in that case, we get circular orbits all the way up to 3m. So this term is just zero. So we can see in that case, this goes to zero when r equals 3m.
Sorry, how did you calculate rc min equal to, why do you have cosines?
Yeah, this is just the general solution to this. And I didn't tell you at all how one would go about deriving that.
Oh, okay.
It just turns out that is.
Right.
But yeah, I guess it's easier to see these pretty specific cases, which we're going to focus on. But just for completeness, that is the general solution.
Excuse me, just to clarify, up to there, we were just looking at the massive particles. And here, when we are setting them equal to like infinity, basically, we are saying that mu goes to zero, and it's like for null spacetimes, null trajectories, right?
You're right in the sense that it turns out that sort of as you approach this limit here, you're actually approaching your particle going at the speed of light, and so right at that, as you approach 3m, that is a null geodesic. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so we probably recognize that as this light ring for a Schwarzschild black hole. And then for an extremal black hole with a spin of 1, we can have circular orbits all the way down to M. So you recall that's actually approaching the horizon of our extremal spinning black hole. And then we can consider the retrograde case where the black hole has a spin of -1, where the particle is has the opposite orientation with respect to it. In that case, the radius for circular orbits goes down to 4m. Yeah, and as you approach these, your energy and increments are blowing up, and it's actually corresponding to a null orbit. Just mentioned. So we have circular orbits all the way down to these radii, but they're not necessarily stable. So as I just drew up here, we can sort of have two different cases, right? So for one case, if we make a small perturbation, we'll actually either be flung out or fall into the black hole. So we want to basically figure out when these circular orbits are stable and when they're unstable. So there's a couple ways we could do that. We could either look at the second derivative of our potential, or we could actually just take the derivative of this expression for the energy. And basically find this, find where it goes to a minimum. And then above there, those would actually be the unstable orbits. So we'll be interested in basically solving that this energy of a circular orbit respect to the radius equals to zero. And that'll correspond to the smallest volume R we have stable circular orbits. So that goes by this acronym ISCO. It's the innermost stable circular orbit. Right, so if we just take that derivative to t equals zero, we get an expression like this. So this is actually a quartic function in the square root of R. So again, a bit involved to actually solve. So I can, yeah, can write down the general expression, but then we'll be sort of interested in checking specific cases again. The general expression, just for completeness, so this corresponds to prograde and retrograde orbits, where A is this. That's not terribly enlightening name, so let's just plug in some actual values of the spin. So again, for non spinning, does anyone remember Schwarzschild black hole, what this the value of the innermost stable circular orbit is? So for six, I heard 6m. Yep. So you can just check that you plug that in, you do indeed get zero. Then again, we can consider the extremal spin case. We have dimensional spin of 1. And in that case, actually, again, you go down to r equals m, the approaching the horizon. And then we can consider the retrograde case. In that case, we get 9m. So you can see that basically, if you're orbiting with the black hole, you can have a stable circular orbit sort of closer to the horizon compared to non-spinning. And it's even worse if you're orbiting sort of with the opposite orientation with respect to the black hole spin. Question.
For extreme spinning black hole, the ISCO and the photon ring are the same.
Yeah, they're approaching each other. Yeah.
Okay, and one thing I'm confused about, so when we are looking at the, we are solving V and the derivative of V to be zero and finding that RC, so we have 2 points on the VR, right? And how we can understand that this one, the on the second board, is corresponding to the non-stable point from here. I mean, we could get these criteria directly by solving for null geodesics from beginning, right?
For null geodesics or time-like geodesics.
So if we consider null geodesics from the beginning, then we can find these critical values of R again, right? The radius of light ring.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. So you can find that you'll have a circular light ring at 3m. Yeah. And it's actually unstable.
And over there, the VR has only one unstable point. The critical point would be just unstable. We don't have that deep there, right?
You're asking for null geodesics? Yeah. For null geodesics, for example, for Schwarzschild, the potential kind of looks like, like this or something, in the sense that, you can have. You just have these unstable points, right? So you can sit here, but then you're either going to fall into the black hole or go out to infinity. Yeah, so this intuition from circular orbits and particularly these innermost stable circular orbits actually is useful for understanding this sort of different astrophysical systems. Even though they're not exactly test particles. So for example, just mentioned a couple of these. So one thing we can imagine is if you have a black hole, and then you have a small, say this is a supermassive black hole, and then you have a small object orbiting around it in a circular orbit. So this can be a stellar mass black hole or a compact star or something like that. And so this is orbiting around in approximately a circle, but it's losing energy to gravitational radiation. So it's gradually losing energy and angular momentum, and its orbit is shrinking. So it's slowly going on a tighter and tighter orbit. Is called a quasi-circular end spiral. So based on the picture we just derived here, how long would you expect this quasi-circular end spiral phase to last? Would you expect it to sort of go all the way down until the particle starts hitting the black hole horizon, or would you expect it to stop before then?
Where are we putting the condition not to get eccentric orbits
here? I'm just saying you start with a circular orbit at very wide separations, and then it's slowly shrinking.
Yeah, right. I get that. I mean, in our equations, these are only for circular orbits, right?
Yeah. We did that when we demanded that we're basically solving for r dot to be zero, right? Yeah, so that's the, or basically that we were solving for the ones that look like this. So it's zero and it's derivative is zero. Yeah.
I didn't quite get the question. You mentioned that we have a circular orbit, like a massive object going through circular orbit, and it loses energy through radiation or something.
Yeah.
And we want to know how long it will take for it to fall in. Or will it stop at some point?
Oh, yeah. Or basically, my question is, when does it stop being a good approximation to think of it as on this sort of slowly varying set of circular orbits? So here you can imagine, it's in spiraling, but it turns out, at wide separations, you can kind of think of it as going through a series of circular orbits. But that's got to stop at some point. My question is, does it stop when it starts hitting the black hole horizon or before then?
Some point it plunges into the black hole.
Yeah.
Does that cause a circle?
Yeah, so what radius do we expect it to plunge? That we just drive it. anybody wanna shout out?
The most stable one? The stable one, the inner one?
Yeah, we basically expect it to start plunging once it reaches the ISCO, the innermost stable circular orbit. So at that point, these stable orbits are actually unstable. So sort of past that point, sort of rapidly gonna plunge into the black hole.
Just because there is no other stable one.
Yeah, it's the radius is decreasing, and past this point, there are no more stable circular orbits.
Is it also the way that people want to look at the binary mergers? They will say, oh, they have like some quasi-circular orbits, and then they get closer and closer, and at some point, it will just like start merger.
Yep. So you're anticipating my next question. So. You know, that even though, for example, for like a binary black hole, that's not quite the test limit. Black holes of comparable mass. It turns out that sort of intuition can apply. So, you know, if you think about the gravitational wave signals we see. So one way to represent these gravitational wave signals is with these sonograms. You've probably seen the famous ones from LIGO and Virgo and so on, where they have a function of time on x-axis and then frequency of the gravitational wave signal on the y-axis. And then you see power. These are called sonograms. So this is power on the gravitational wave signal. And so you basically see this characteristic chirp. We have a signal that's kind of increasing in frequency with time, and then at some point sort of diverges as the objects come together. And of course, there's some noise here, and since it's really in frequency, it's evolving, but that's the basic shape. So another question we can sort of use this intuition for is, say we have two signals that sort of the same, are very similar frequency, time evolution, sort of at early times, but this chirp up as the objects then rapidly come together as they plunge. And one of them occurs at earlier times. And for another one, sort of persists for longer and then plunges up at a later time and higher frequency. What could we say about the sort of spins of the two objects in these different cases, say if they're binary black holes? So if this one were non-spinning black holes, would this one correspond to sort of spins that were aligned with the orbital angular momentum or anti-aligned?
Aligned,
yeah. Because then we expect the black holes to be able to sort of orbit closer together before eventually plunging. This sort of shootout happens as the objects plunge and get more orbits closer together with their aligned spin. So you can kind of think of there being an effective ISCO for the binary system. Of course, it's not as simple as the test body case.
By plunge here, you mean that if an object reaches, let's say for a spin equal to zero, r equal to 6m, it still could run away, but if it goes anywhere in, closer to the black hole, it can't? Is that what you're saying? Because with the frequency thing that you just said, I interpreted this way, that if it was like 9m, after they get closer to 9m together, you're not getting any signal anymore?
So yeah, once you reach this ISCO, so which would, for example, be 9m for retrograde, extremal spin, basically then there are no more stable circular orbits. So then you basically expect like a small perturbation to put you on one of these orbits is just going to plunge into the black hole. Like, you know, your potential is going to sort of look like, you know, it's going to be like you're right here, right? Just a small perturbation will make it so that you want to just fall straight into the black hole. So you're no longer kind of be evolving on these roughly circular orbits. You're going to sort of rapidly start plunging into the black hole. I mean, it won't be instantaneous, of course, but yeah. Yeah, so sometimes people use this terminology. This is the orbital hang-up effect, in the sense that you can sort of get more orbits by adding a line spin.
Is there a function that would exactly correlate the frequency, the time, with the spin? So if the spin of the black hole is like 0.4, what would be the shape of this thing?
So for the binary black hole case, yeah, it's a bit complicated. I mean, to sort of get the last few orbits of a comparable mass system.
And also, would this be the maximum of the two, each black hole has its own R ISCO, so that would be the maximum R ISCO of the two?
Again, it's a little bit complicated to go to the binary case, but like essentially you can kind of think of it as there's some effective ISCO of the combined system, which one can, you know, a sort of a cartoon sort of way think of as thinking of like the final object that's going to be created by sort of combining the two spins of the black holes,
you add up the spins of the two black holes and you look at the R
ISCO. Add up the, so you can get sort of a decent approximation to sort of where you expect the effective separation where you plunge by saying just adding up the angular momentum of the two black holes and then dividing by their total mass square, and that's kind of the spin of the effective system. Of course, that's not exactly right. I mean, we're talking about comparable mass black holes, really, in the very dynamical strong field regime. And to get the right answer, you have to solve the full equations. But that definitely is sort of the sign of the effect. You can all get that intuition just from this geodesic picture.
So, but the qualitatively, it's kind of clear, but quantitatively, it's not.
Why do we say why do they have to follow approximate circular orbit before? Like,
is there perturbative?
But like, they can just, depending on the initial impact parameter, they can just do whatever they like. Why do they have to follow?
Right, yeah. So, in general, you're saying we have some elliptic orbit or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's definitely possible. So at some point we'll talk about how actually gravitational waves have this property that they actually tend to circularize orbits. And that basically comes from the way that a gravitational wave will carry away in proportion to energy and angular momentum. I think I actually worked that out for homework problems, but we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. But that sort of gives you some intuition for why, if you start with a eccentric orbit with very wide separations and it's evolving under gravitational radiation, it's going to want to settle to this quasi-circular in spiral. And sort of once you're in this quasi-circular in spiral, the gravitational radiation will sort of keep you in these approximately circular orbits. But yeah, in general, for these systems, you can also imagine, and we'll talk about next, parabolic orbits where you have some flyby and then you go back out, or things like that too.
But here we are choosing the initial condition such that there are solutions to that equation, right? So it means that the impact parameter is such that they are going to start a quasi-circular loop. Because the EEC and JC.
These that I wrote down are exactly just for circular orbits, yes.
Comment, I was thinking maybe if we make examples of, make an example of Emery's, it would be more sensible of how we can look at those two.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at here, Emery's.
Because, as you mentioned, for the comparable mass, then the ISCO would not be straight.
Yeah, but I think the point is, I mean, for Emery's, this should be definitely applicable. For comparable mass, it's not obvious that it should be, but in fact, it does give you some good intuition, even though it shouldn't be sort of strictly valid there. And the last example I wanted to give is considering accretion disks around black holes. A lot of times people are interested in trying to measure the spins of black holes by, so these are black holes that have some cloud of gas around them, and their gas is being accreted onto the black hole, and it's sending out light in terms of X-rays or other emission, and astronomers are interested in basically trying to measure the spin of the black hole by looking at the emission. And so, again, you can imagine, so this is sort of a head-on look. So we have some accretion disk. The top-down view would be, you have a black hole here, and you have some disk of material around the black hole. At some radius, this accretion disk terminates. When you're solving for these accretion disk solutions, you can guess what radius we expect the accretion disk to terminate at. It'd be the ISCO. And so you can look at where the emission is coming from and try to determine if it's this emission from the accretion disk is coming from very close to the black hole potential, as opposed to further away, that would correspond to what kind of black hole spin. Would it be high spin or low spin?
If you have a very supermassive black hole, then I think the ISCO is an, or if it's a extremely spinning. So at 9M is the ISCO, right?
That's if you're counter-rotating.
Yeah, counter-rotating. So I want to have an example that the ISCO is very far, relatively far. But my point is that still the plunge rate is finite, right? The plunge speed. So it means that still we might see particles in between that region. And it takes some time for materials from the accretion disk to plunge into the black hole. So how accurate would that approximation be if we cut the disk exactly at the ISCO?
So I mean, basically, if you want a steady state, obviously it has to be here. Mm-hmm. But then for a real system, you expect the black hole will be accreting some of it. So some material is going to be sort of falling in at the ISCO and
so
getting a CT in the black hole. And you might get a little bit of emission here, but
up to the photon ring, right? As close as photon, after a photon ring, we cannot see them, right?
The photon ring would be where you have you just have these unstable circular orbits. In theory, you could get emission all the way up to the horizon. Right? You do have some little geodesics to escape. The point is the sort of the non-plunging part of the accretion disk has to sit at larger radius. And so if you have some, so basically what the shape of the accretion disk is, and how close it extends to the black hole horizon will depend sensitively on the spin. So if you have some model for that, you try to fit your observations, you can try to leverage that to get a measurement of the black hole spin.
Is there another way to estimate the mass of the black hole? Because if we were to estimate the spin, you have to first know what the mass is. Because if you don't, let's say you get a big ISCO radius, but and then you want to say my A is minus one, but maybe your M is too big.
Yeah. So definitely correct. If you just have the distance of this, then you also need to know the black hole mass.
How do you calculate that?
Yeah, you would also need to have some, like, try to back that out of your observations. Whether it be from like orbits around the black hole or your accretion disk model or something like that. But in some sense, the mass is a bit easier to get, right? Because like you just need to have some observation that kind of tells you the Newtonian potential, right? But then the spin is a bit harder in the sense that
right.
It's more sensitive to things closer by. But yeah, you need both.
One more question.
Yep.
So I have a kind of naive question. If we imagine a just Schwarzschild black hole, and then we imagine a particle passes the 3M,
mm-hmm.
but it's radiating. It's, I don't know, charged particle accelerating and radiating some photons. Those photons are inside the light ring, right? Can they still get out of the light ring? Because then it's not stable, so they eventually get into the black hole, the photons that are being emitted inside the light ring.
Not necessarily. They can get out, but like they cannot be out of a circular orbit.
How can they get out?
Like, the N1 ring is actually inside 3M, and it still gets out. Like, it's not horizon.
Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah.
But
the circular orbit is unstable. These are two different things.
So we're defining the horizon as where, place where even, null curves have to enter the black hole horizon. So that's that point. But this 3M, for example, is where it's like unstable light ring. These unstable circular orbits for null GL6. Does that answer your question?
I think so. It means that if the photon there has a positive velocity, then it can still come out. But if the dr over dt is negative, then eventually it's going to get into. So all the photons with negative radial speed would eventually plunge into the black hole within the light ring, right? Is that correct?
Maybe, yeah. So we didn't actually derive the potential for null rays. There are definitely some null geodesics once you get past that point that if they're emitting away from the black hole, they can escape.
So the ingoings would all get into the black hole, but outgoing could still get out.
Okay, so this is is there another question? So this was, we just discussed bound orbits, particularly these circular orbits. So now I'm going to switch slightly and discuss marginally bound orbits. That's where this E tilde would be equal to 1. So in Newtonian mechanics, you know, sometimes call these marginally bound orbits parabolic orbits. That's because they look like parabolas, right? In Jara, things can actually be more complicated. You can have things that look like that. Or as you'll sort of work out for yourself in the tutorials, you can actually have even more complicated things that go like that. But we'll still call these parabolic orbits, even though they're not necessarily parabolas. So if we plug in this marginally bound condition to this expression all the way up there, we can notice that the highest order term in R goes to zero. So big simplify. And our potential just becomes this. So now this part of brackets here is just quadratic, so we can solve that easily for the roots. We get the turning points of our parabolic orbit, so we call it RP. So with this, we can either get two real roots, or we get no roots. So we can we sort of sketch what this potential could look like. R could have something like this, where particle could come in from infinity and just fall all the way to the black hole. Or we could have something like this, where our particle would come in, reach some finite radius, and then go back out again. And so if we're interested in finding what's sort of the dividing line between this and this, again, it's going to be where this determinant goes to zero. So if we just set this equal to that, we get the following expression for the marginal case. And then we can plug in this J marginal into this expression and evaluate RP is, and we get the following. And so basically, if we have any parabolic or marginally bound orbits where R is less than this this RP, then they're gonna plunge into the black hole, will be in this case. So this is basically the smallest radius you can have these orbits that come in, go close to the black hole, and then go back out again on these partially bound orbits. So let's evaluate this for a couple of different cases again of spin. So for extremal, we just plug in one here, and then we get RP equals M. So again, you're sort of skimming the black hole horizon. Again, plug in the non-spinny case. And there we get 4M. So we can see that this is sort of you can get closer to the black hole and go back out again on a circular orbit. Remember the ISCO for a non-spinning black hole was 6M. And then for retrograde spin, we get V plus 2 times the square root of 2, which is about 5.8m. So we get less than the 9m we had for circular orbits. Yeah, so you know, again, we can think about sort of how this might help us understand astrophysical situations. So again, we can imagine sort of an event that astronomers have been observing, which are called tidal disruption events. So there you have some black hole, and you have a star that sort of kicked onto an orbit where it comes in from far away and passes by close to the star, and if it gets sufficiently close to the black hole, actually the tidal forces, you know, the fact that the part of the star closest to the black hole will feel a stronger gravitational pull as opposed to the one farther away, can actually pull the star apart, and so as it comes in, that can start to spread, and some of the material will fall back on the black hole, and you'll get some sort of electromagnetic emission from this. It turns out that the tidal forces that you get, they'll depend on how compact the star is, and what the black hole's mass is, whether or not you get this tidal disruption will also depend on the spin of the black hole. So the closer you get to the black hole, the stronger the sort of tidal forces, and you can have orbits where the star comes close to the black hole, on one of these parabolic orbits without falling in. If the black hole is extreme. Has extremal spin. We're not interested in the case where it kind of plunges, because if all the star's material falls in right away, then you don't get as a dramatic emission. But the most dramatic emission when you have this material that sort of spreads out and somewhat falls back and then eventually falls into the black hole. So, with extremal black hole spin, you can have these parabolic orbits that get closer to the black hole. And these more extreme tidal disruption events. Finally, we can mention when we can have a parabolic orbit that actually enters the ergosphere. So if you recall from a couple lectures ago, we said that in the equatorial plane, the ergo region extends to 2m. So this parabolic orbit, we can see, at least for an extremal black hole, these parabolic orbits extend into the erg region. And it turns out sort of the critical value where you have minimum radius of parabolic orbit is less than 2m. That actually occurs in this condition that which requires about somewhat extreme spin of about 0.91. So maybe this is a good place to stop here. So in the next lecture, we'll discuss how we can sort of exploit these parabolic orbits that go into the ergo region to extract energy from the rotating black hole in something that's known as the Penrose process. But let me stop here and ask if there are any questions.
So where is this 4m exactly, the Fort Schwarzschild case? It's that radius that we are finding, I cannot get.
Did I make a
picture if you want to, for example, draw it? Where is it the closest distance between the star and the black hole when the 4m?
This is the periastron distance. It's the distance of closest approach to the black hole.
So if it's larger than that, then it would escape.
What I'm working out here is like the. Basically, you can imagine, when this diagram here. You're coming in from infinity, and you hit some turning point where the potential is equal to zero. And so this turning point is this radius of closest approach, and then you go back out again. And so basically the closest you can get to the black hole, where you don't have a orbit that actually just falls all the way into the black hole, are these values for these different spins.
And one thing I don't get, the cases that you can turn orbit the black hole a couple of times and then get back to infinity. How can that happen? It only happens for care, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so like, here the... So actually these are... you actually... sort of work out some of these orbits for yourself in tutorial, but these ones that sort of orbit the black hole for many times are actually called zoom whirl orbits, and you can in some sense think of them as perturbations about these unstable orbits. If you sort of have something that's close to one of these unstable orbits, it can depending on how finely you tune it to that orbit, it can go around many times, and then either go back out to infinity or fall into the black hole. That would be sort of the extreme case.
Could this happen way closer to the black hole as the ISCO radius? For particular m's, let's say you have a equal to zero. You have a equal to 1, because that would R be equal to M. So then this kind of the light going around the black hole multiple times before falling in or going out, could that happen? So could that happen in a radius that is much less than R ISCO?
Yeah, so basically, for example, if we consider circular orbits, then basically... as we discussed being in class, from r equals 6m to r equals 3m, you have circular orbits, but they're all unstable, right? So you can imagine taking perturbations of those unstable circular orbits, right? So make a small perturbation, it's either going to, so you could, if you're finely tuned, just go around the black hole in this unstable circular orbit, but you make a small perturbation, and it's going to either be flung out or fall into the black hole. So it's exactly these orbits that are a small perturbation around the unstable ones that will give you this zoom world.
It kind of doesn't make sense to me. I don't know why. Because for example, for a ball equal to zero, your R, I don't know, call it pre-Hillian, what do you call it? Pre-axis? The closest approach or whatever is equal to and the ISCO for A equal to zero is 6m, so that would be smaller than the ISCO radius by 2m for A equal to zero. So this kind of thing that it can go around the black hole many times could happen at a radius significantly smaller than R ISCO. And if you look at the image, let's say, and you see some sort of a ring that is going around the black hole, how could you say that that's ISCO, or is it this kind of thing? And how could you differentiate between these two when you look at an image, let's say?
You're asking what's the difference between these, like...
Between the ring that is made by a unstable orbit going around the black hole many times and then going away, and the accretion flow of the black hole going around the black hole at R ISCO, which would be 6m. And if you look at the black hole, do you see two rings? Well, I'm trying to figure out how it looks. So it's like two rings? It's like one at 6m, one at 4m?
Yeah, the Zumer orbits are, in some sense, kind of finely tuned, right? Just to clarify. So, I mean, you can actually have these unstable orbits for sort of different values of angular momentum. So here, this 4m is for these... this is for parabolic orbits, right?
Yeah.
And then before, the 6m is the... So that radius for circular orbits, as opposed to parabolic. If you sort of have a orbit that's a perturbation around one of these unstable orbits, so it's some radius that's below one of the innermost stable orbits, then you can have this zoom world type behavior. But that, in some sense, like this is not the generic behavior you expect, because getting a lot of these whirls kind of requires fine tuning your orbital parameters.
So you're saying, this thing doesn't happen quite as much. Going around the black hole so many times and then.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the number of times you go around corresponds to like how finely tuned you are to the like exactly.
Right.
So, for example, a small body orbit around a black hole, like we expect, the perturbation is going to be due to the gravitational radiation. So that'll kind of set how some small perturbation that will make it quickly plunge.
This not visible? If you look at a picture of a black hole, is this kind of thing the unstable thing? You wouldn't expect to see it when you look at an image. Let's say if someone tells you, "I got an image of the black hole. Here you go." Would you expect to see the unstable or orbits going around the black hole many, many times, or you would say, "Okay, that's very unlikely"?
Yeah, I think you'd expect more of the gas to start plunging past this point, and we can have some emission from it or something. Yeah, you don't expect it to.
See the ring, that second ring.
Yeah, you don't expect it to be knocked onto these you expect it to, basically, actually, in one of the tutorials, you're going to sort of calculate basically what's the Lyapunov exponent of these orbits.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, in some sense, that tells you the time scale. Like if you make a small perturbation, that's the time scale which the unstable part is going to grow. So you'll calculate that, but it's going to be sort of characteristic of the, it's going to be order of m, in the black hole mass. So you don't expect that to necessarily sit there to stay there a long time on one of these unstable circular orbits because they're unstable.
Right. So you wouldn't expect to see it because you're saying it requires a lot of fine tuning for that particular radius for the orbit to go around the black hole enough time so that it could be visible.
Yeah. I mean, like we're saying, we'll get some emission from stuff along maybe here.
More for the matter is.
Any other questions?
Would you see the plunging material into the black hole? Would you see that if you took an image of the black hole? Would you expect to see that at least or not? Because, I don't know, when I saw pictures of black holes, it was like a black thing in the middle and some material far away. But I don't know. Do people see the stuff plunging in?
Yeah, well, we have some members of the HD.
Well, do people see stuff plunging in?
If you talk to Avery Project, I mean, he says that, it's not a misnomer to call this the Event Horizon Telescope as opposed to like the whatever, photon ring telescope or ISCO telescope or something, because some of the emission you get is coming from stuff that's kind of plunging into the black hole.